Welcome to Follow Your Curiosity, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Creativity. Here's how to get unstuck. I'm your host, creativity coach, Nancy Norbeck. Let's go. Raquel Drossos started writing when she was 5 and has rarely stopped. As a teenager, she wrote and published 3 young adult novels under her maiden name, Raquel George. Games of Chance is her first book for adults. She also blogs about parenting and the creative process. Raquel talks with me about the intersection between acting and writing, plotting versus writing by the seat of your pants, the moment when your characters come to life in your head, which is not a sign of madness, her next novel, and more. She also shares some excellent advice she got from her dad. Here's my conversation with Raquel Drossos. Raquel, welcome to Follow Your Curiosity.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So I start everybody off with the same question, which is, were you a creative kid or did you discover your creative side later on?
I was a very creative kid. I was always telling stories. My parents say that as soon as I started talking, I never stopped talking to this day. And I actually have memories of being like 4 or 5 and having dozens of imaginary friends, like a bunch of them. And I would go to my grandma's house and she would pretend that my imaginary friends were coming over for dinner. So she would like put a plate out for them at the table and have them ring the doorbell. She totally played along with the whole thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So like I had a lot of encouragement to be creative. My grandma, like I said, and my parents were always very supportive of my creativity too. And I wrote my first book when I was 5. It was 3 sentences, so it wasn't a long one, but it was the start of my writing career, you know, and ever since then, I didn't stop writing. I've always had writing as a part of my life.
That's fantastic. I love your grandmother.
Yeah, she was great. She really, very encouraging.
Yeah. Well, and I totally relate to the whole, once I started talking, I never stopped thing. So many times my mother has said to me, you know, I used to wish that you would start talking. Well, you got your wish, didn't
right.
you?
It's like that. But my daughter, too, my daughter is almost 7 and she is like always telling me stories and always talking. And I'm like, I want to be encouraging, but at the same time, I'm just like, I got to think for a minute, you know? So I understand how my parents felt.
Yeah, I do, too. But at the same time, it's like, well, you know, could have been worse, right? Could have never said anything to you at all.
Right. True. It's better to share.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there are all the parents who are like, my kids never talk. So yeah. So you wrote your 3-sentence book when you were 5. That's fantastic. What about your parents? Did they encourage you the same way your grandmother did?
Yeah. So they didn't have like artistic careers, either one of them. My dad is a retired firefighter. My mom's in new business development. But they're both like innately creative people in different ways. Like my dad was always a really good storyteller and my mom is very good at drawing and like interior design and that kind of thing. But they didn't really have much to do with the writing world, but they were very, very encouraging and supportive. They're like the kind of people who like with me and my brothers, whatever we wanted to do, they were always all in with that. You know, they're like, okay, whatever, you know, this crazy idea, we'll jump on board. When I was in middle school, I wanted to have my own TV show. So my parents were like, okay. And my parents were like, okay, we can have a TV show. Sure. They drove me and my friends around to these different locations to film the sitcom I wrote. And we put it on public access TV and, you know, they took everybody out for pizza afterwards. So they were always very on board with my ideas. And I feel really grateful that I had that start, you know, where I was never told like, oh, you can't do that. Or that's ridiculous. People don't do that. Like I was always, encouraged to like try new things.
That's fantastic. And I love that you actually made something like that and put it on public access TV. What happened when you put it out there?
It was pretty hilarious. Everybody in my school watched it, you know, and they like, some people were like very supportive and some people were like, I saw the little, you know, mistake in, you know, scene 4 or whatever, you know, like how teenagers are.
Right.
But it was really fun. So we had like 6 episodes. It was about girls at a boarding school. I mean, not a boarding school, a boarding house. You know, who didn't have families and just like their general teenage, you know, trials and tribulations. And all my friends were in it and I was in it and we had a really fun run, but you know, obviously it was a lot of work. So we did like 6 episodes over a year or so and then we stopped, but it was a lot of fun. I was always involved in acting as a young person too. I don't do that anymore, but I liked that as a young person.
Wow. 6 episodes is way more than I expected you to say. That is some serious, serious dedication. And you were,
it was fun.
Middle school?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. And I love that you brought up acting, because I feel like acting and writing are kind of two sides of the same coin. Like, writing to me has always felt like playing all the parts. I don't know if you've noticed the same thing, but it's kind of like, this is sort of like my movie, but I'm doing everything.
Yeah, it's so true. It's like you similarly have to like embody all these different characters the way that if you're acting, you have to really put yourself in that person's head, the way they talk, the way they gesture, you know, what they think and everything. I definitely agree with that. And I liked, I don't know what this says about me, but I like writing novels because I can be all the characters, as opposed to, you know, when you're acting or even when you write a screenplay, you write all the characters, but then the actor kind of takes them over and brings them to life. But when you're doing a novel, you're like, this is all mine. I could do whatever I want. So it's definitely a different type of control.
Yeah, you get to be the control freak when you're doing the writing.
Yeah.
but it's interesting, too, that you mention if you're writing a play or a screenplay, because I have written exactly one play that was ever produced, a little 10-minute play. And I remember feeling, you know, when I heard people talk to me about what was going on in the rehearsal, I kind of decided it would be better for me not to know, right? Because, like, I had this vision of what these characters were like. And, you know, the thing that surprised me was that, like, they decided to do one character. It was like an angel devil on your shoulder kind of thing. And they're like, yeah, the devil guy is like playing it like he's very, very, you know, New York, New Jersey and whatever. And I was like, what? And then when I finally saw it, I was like, you know what? This actually works. This is cool. But hearing about it without seeing all of that, your brain kind of goes, or at least mine did, goes into all of the ways that this could just be a complete disaster. What are they thinking? Oh, my God. And I think that's because you get used to the idea that when you're the writer, you're totally in control. And then somebody else comes in and you sort of have to sit back and say, it's not mine anymore. Like, the words are mine, but somebody else gets to do whatever they want with it. And that is totally their right. And I have no right to sit here feeling like, what are you doing to my thing? Even though I did.
Yeah, that's so true. It's tough to just like put your stuff out there and know that someone else will interpret it however they want, however they think is right, you know?
Yeah, I think it helps that, you know, I grew up singing in choirs with a mother who was a choir director. And she had said to me at one point, you know, look, you know, somebody wrote this piece of music, but once I get it, it's up to me to decide what else to do with it. They're out of it. And I think that's what I landed on in that experience. Kind of like, yeah, this is the same thing. I'm out of it now. I have handed it over to other people. And, you know, it's either retain control over it for the rest of your life, or no one ever produces your play.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what that is. Or you can let them do their thing, and it worked. So shows you what I know.
Yeah. Well, no, it's cool too, because then you get to see your own work through like totally different eyes, which it's hard to really do when it's a novel. I mean, obviously you could have people tell you, well, I thought this about this scene or this character, but for someone else to really like creatively touch your work, that is an interesting feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very different thing. And I think too, having had that experience probably helped when I went off to get my MFA. And, you know, then you've got all sorts of people sticking fingers into what you've done. And if you can't let go of it as a part of you, that is really hard.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So when did you decide to do writing more seriously?
So, again, when I was a teenager, I wrote three novels. They were young adult mystery novels. So when I was about 14, I was writing this one novel. It was called, it was actually two novellas in one. One was called Jill, and one was called Until Proven Innocent. And while I was writing the second one of those, I like realized that the kind of flow state I was getting into when I was writing was unlike anything else I was doing in my life. Even though I was doing acting and I was doing a lot of like hobbies that I enjoyed, I was like, wow, this is like the most passionate, intense feeling ever. I am so absorbed in this world and I want to just keep doing this. I love this. This is really like what I was meant to do. I wrote this great journal entry about how I was going to be a writer and that was my life's goal and all this stuff. And I can't find the journal entry now. I wish I could. But like, I really, you know, realized that this was a calling and that this was something that was different from anything else I was involved in. So I wrote the three novels as a teenager and self-published them. My parents were very supportive on that path too, and helped me get them out in the world and do, you know, book signings and things like that. And then I stopped writing for a while when I was in college. I kind of like, well, there's a couple of different things that went into it. I was writing a novel in high school that I eventually scrapped because it just wasn't working. But I had been working on it for years and I was really invested in these characters. And then like coming to that moment of saying, I have to give this up, this is never going to work, was very earth-shattering for me because, you know, I was very attached to this world. And spoiler alert, two of the characters from that novel ended up in my novel Games of Chance, which I released last year. So we'll get to that in a minute, but they didn't totally go away. But anyway, so giving up that novel and then being in college and feeling like I was learning all these different perspectives and my life was changing so much, I just wasn't writing very much. I wasn't feeling very creative. But funny enough, during that time, I started working at this jewelry store where we would teach people how to make jewelry. So like people would buy beads and stones and things, and we would make necklaces and earrings and stuff with them. And I was kind of depressed until I started working at that store. And that like ignited my creativity in a different way. So then I was just making jewelry all the time. You know, at the time I didn't realize that that was helping to feed the part of me that needed to make things. But now that I look back, I realize like that got me through my writing drought, the fact that I was still making. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, so then after college, I started writing Games of Chance, which is my first novel for adults that came out last year. And it's about adoptive siblings growing up in an Italian-American family in New Jersey and the different paths they take in their lives. So it follows Alex, Seb, and Amelia from a tragedy that brings them together in childhood. And then all the way through till their late 20s as they start careers and have romantic relationships and grow up. So like I said, two of the characters from my novel that I gave up in high school, Alex and Seb, ended up in Games of Chance. The plot's completely different than that high school novel, but I brought the characters back. So that makes me happy that they didn't go away.
Yeah. I love that you didn't totally discard something from high school. I just wrote recently about how my 10th grade English teacher, one of the first things that he told us at the beginning of the school year was to always save and date a draft. Like, you know, you never know when some piece of that that you didn't think worked or, you know, that just sticks with you wants to come out in some other form. So I think it's very cool that you did that. Did they just kind of keep living in your head, or did you have an idea and think these characters are perfect, or how did that work?
That's great advice by your teacher. I like that.
Yeah.
Ever since I gave up that old novel, I couldn't really give up on Alex and Seb. So in the old novel and in Games of Chance, they have this relationship where they're raised as brothers, but they're not brothers. So I found that very fascinating. And they're super, super close, but they're very different. So Seb is this very pensive, kind of brooding character. He tends to be very pessimistic about life. And Alex, on the other hand, is like extremely charismatic and outgoing and, you know, like the life of the party, but they're very close. So I really like their dynamic. And I tried to put them in different stories over the years, like short stories and other novels that I started and didn't finish, but there was never like the right space for them. So then after college, I started writing about this character, Amelia, who is a runner, and she's very, very disciplined, very self-critical. And I really was fascinated by her character. And at some point I was like, well, what if she had brothers and Alex and Seb were her brothers? And then the story just took off from there. Once I had those three together, the way that they related to each other was just like so many stories were just, you know, pouring out of that relationship. So,
yeah, I think there's real magic in that moment. Like when you suddenly put the right combination of things together and it's like you have ignition, it just goes. And so whether it's the combination of characters or, oh, I was trying to write this thing in totally the wrong way, you know, I had structured it the wrong way, or it turns out it wanted to be a poem and not a short story, you know, or whatever it is, there's such a magical moment when it's like, oh, see, now I don't even have to do anything. It's just happening all on its own. Not really all on its own, but yes, kind of really all on its own all at the same time.
Yeah, it does feel like that sometimes. It definitely feels like magic. It's like you do the work of the actual, you know, sitting down, writing the sentences, fixing the sentences, but that like spark of, I know this is working and I'm like on board, I'm holding your hand, I'm on the ride, you know, that's like something you can't replicate in any other way. It's a really amazing feeling.
Yeah. And it's one that you can't always engineer. I think it's trial and error a lot more than you know, I think it needs to be X plus Y equals Z.
Yeah, it's so true. Like a lot of times people have asked me about, you know, things like, well, why did you write about this concept? Or did you, you know, what was the process for this or that? And for me, I'm like, what happens is I get people in my head. I always have people in my head. And when I'm interested in them, I just follow them where they take me. Like I didn't intend to write a story about adoption, but that was the story they were telling me. Like, so it sounds crazy, but that's really how I feel, that the ideas come that way.
So I take it that you are a pantser and not a plotter.
I'm a little bit of both. I definitely like, I leave myself open for like those moments of like, this is what I have to do. Like the, you know, the sparks, but I usually have like a general idea of where the story is going. I usually know the end. And I know like certain guideposts along the way that I have to get to. So I'll have like big scenes that I'll brainstorm and like write them, write a draft of them before I'm there. Mm-hmm. And then I know I have to get to that part at some point. So like not every single thing is planned out, but it's not completely like wide open.
Sure.
What about you? Do you?
I'm pretty much a pantser, but I have had moments where I'm like, I know I need to get to X. I have no idea how I'm getting to X, but I know that we need to get there at some point.
Yeah.
You know, but X is not necessarily the end. X could be some random thing in the middle that I just know has to happen. And it fascinates me. Do you ever hear from people who are plotters who don't believe that pantsing is possible?
Yeah, definitely. People are like, you got to have an outline with like Roman numeral one.
Yeah.
And they're just like, how do you get to where you need to go? And I'm like, because I know I need to get there. Like, I don't have to plan every, like, I don't know. I guess it sounds crazy, but it's like you said, you're like, this is X needs to be in the story. So we're going to figure out how to get it into the story. We're just going to let it, you know, happen, you know? And then sometimes things don't work. Like sometimes you get to X and you're like, oh, X isn't really that good. I thought it was going to be good, but it doesn't work. But it still guided you as you were, you know, going through the journey. So I feel like that's important. There's been plenty of scenes that I'm like, this is my favorite scene in the book. And then I get to it and I'm like, this doesn't make any sense anymore. I have to throw it out. But still, it helped me to develop the characters, develop the plot, that kind of thing.
Right. And I feel like I have been a little bit remiss in not defining for people who are not writers. There were the plotters, the people who have to plot out every single thing and outline it all and whatever before they can write something. And then there are people who are pantsers, which is short for writing by the seat of your pants, who have no idea what in the heck we're doing. And we do it anyway. And then when it's done, we go back and we say, so what did I screw up? What doesn't match here that I said over here, you know, and whatever. And what questions do I still have? I've heard it pantsing described as plotting in reverse. And that makes sense to me, that you're kind of, you're fixing the plot afterwards after you see what you've got. And to me, that part is a lot of fun, because it's like finding all of the little pieces and all the questions that I have as I'm going through and being like, huh, okay, what does this part tell me about all of these characters that I should beef up somewhere else? You know, that kind of stuff. Or maybe this, does this plot point not make sense, or is it trying to tell me something? And to me, that's really, really fascinating, much more fascinating than knowing every step along the way, which Margaret Atwood described as being like paint by numbers, which is how it feels to me too. Obviously, plotters do not feel that way. There is no right or wrong with either one. It's just what works for you, but it can sometimes be a big debate. And yeah, I've definitely seen people who are like, it's not possible to write a novel that way. And I'm like, but I did it.
Here it is. Yeah.
Margaret Atwood clearly does it. You know, other people have clearly done this and written great things. So I'm pretty sure it's possible. Yeah. But you can stay over there and believe what you want to believe.
Exactly. And I think what you said is the most important thing, that you have to do what works for you. Like people, like when a lot of times when you take classes, like they want to teach you like, this is the method. And like everybody really has their own method. I mean, obviously you should be reading good novels and educating yourself, but like nobody can tell you how you're supposed to write it. That's what comes from you. So I definitely steer clear of people who are like, this is the craft and it goes like this, for whatever, you know, whatever their philosophy might be. I think everybody, that's why every novel is different, because everybody's voice is different. Everybody's process is different.
Yeah, I think that there are certainly things that you can learn about what makes a book work, what makes a book work well, you know, techniques to, you know, make your characters clearer or all sorts of things. But how you put all of those things together is really what's up to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And yet people get very territorial.
It's true. Yeah. Very true.
It's really wild.
But yeah, like I said, I think the most important thing with like, if people were, you know, wanted to start writing and they trying to figure out how and that kind of thing, like the thing that helps me the most is reading, and that I always read a lot as a child. I like to read now, and I try to read only books that I, you know, admire and think are really good. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with enjoying like a guilty pleasure thing, but if you're a writer, you really shouldn't do that because you might start writing like the sentences that you read. You disagree?
I don't know. I think you can read a guilty pleasure and still be you on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's an awareness thing, right?
It's like, yeah, maybe that's,
maybe
yeah.
You're sitting there thinking, I'm loving this, but I don't ever want to write anything like it. Which True. Sounds really kind of condescending. And I don't necessarily mean it that way. I think you can really enjoy it,
mm-hmm.
but know that this is not where your work lives.
Yeah. It's like, to me, like not only not like a genre thing, like I wouldn't put down any genre at all. All genres are awesome in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a thing about like word choice and sentences. I feel like mm-hmm. I'm very affected by what I read and my sentences change based on what I'm reading. So that kind of thing.
Yeah. Like when you suddenly find yourself starting to use a phrase and you don't know why, and you realize it's because somebody, you know, says it all the time.
Yeah.
Like, how did this end up in my psyche? So there is that. There is that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting how what you read influences you. And there are people who like won't read anything while they're working on something because they're so afraid of being influenced. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a legitimate concern. I think if you know, it's kind of the same thing, you know, if you know where your work is and where your sensibilities are, you're not going to be unduly influenced by something you read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like your book is suddenly going to turn into, you know, Jodi Picoult's book. I mean, it's going to be your book. And I know that there were people when I was doing my MFA, I would talk to people who were writers, and they would, you know, at different levels, not anything necessarily like a professional writer or an MFA level, just, you know, people I worked with or whatever. And they would say, oh, but I don't want to, you know, read all these other people's things because then it'll, you know, I won't be as creative. And I was like, but where do you think your ideas come from?
Yeah.
Right. You know, exactly. Not that you're stealing them, but all the different things that you read kind of simmer in this kind of creative stew in your psyche. And you don't necessarily know when you come up with an idea which part of it came from the Jodi Picoult novel you read 6 years ago and which didn't. But that's not a bad thing, I don't think. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, just like feed your creativity. I feel like for me, it helps me to do like to be exposed to other kinds of art a lot so that like that gives me ideas, but it's not necessarily in the form of like words. So they could kind of, like you said, be in a stew and come out in like weird ways that sometimes I can't even say like, where did that come from? But I know it came from what I was feeding. Like, I know that you were on a music podcast, that Springsteen podcast,
yes.
That I was too. And like, I love music and I find that that helps me a lot. Like not listening while I'm writing, but just throughout my day, listening to music and just like having a lot of emotions attached to whatever I'm listening to. That gives me a lot of ideas. And then, yeah, just anything else like visual art and stuff like that too, can just like spark something that you wouldn't have thought of just, you know, being in your own head.
Yeah. I mean, I really kind of wonder where do these people come up with stuff if they're not feeding anything? Because like you say, it can be a phrase from a song. It can be a billboard that you happen to see while you were thinking about something completely different and the two come together. I mean, it's ideas are everywhere, but most of us don't pay any attention.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I actually wrote a blog post about being more imaginative. So I write a blog on my website, raqueldrosos.com. And I write about creativity and I write about writing. And I also write about being a parent. And so like I watched my kids who are very imaginative, very creative. They're 4 and 6, and how they're always coming up with stories and they're always seeing some kind of, you know, they always see things through the lens of, you know, like, a story, like a fantasy world. They're always coming up with something. And they're always drawing. My daughter plays the drums. And, you know, having conversations with other parents about creativity and how to foster it. And I promise I'm getting to a point.
It's okay.
I kind of took a long path. But anyway, I find that when people are too busy with just like tasks or with, you know, daily life, it's very hard to have ideas. And so I wrote a blog post about how a lot of kids are like very, very, very overscheduled, and they're not just sitting around drawing with crayons. And maybe that's why they don't have like new ideas or whatever. So, but when I was writing that blog post, I was thinking about myself and about, you know, when you're like waiting in line at the supermarket or waiting at the doctor's office and everybody's on their phone. And I always try not to take out my phone because I like to look around at the people that I'm around, you know, and kind of like think about like, those people don't seem to be very happy today with each other. Like, I wonder what's going on in their life, you know, like, or like, wow, like that outfit that person is wearing is so fascinating. I never would have put that together. Like, that must be a really creative person. And like, I think that there's little moments throughout the day where you could be inspired by something. And if you're always just like looking at your phone or like scrolling or busying yourself with something else, you're not going to notice those things.
Amen to that. I mean, I feel like there's a ton of stuff in there that we could talk about, because I think if you have kids or are around kids a lot, you're going to get ideas just because their creativity is infectious.
Yeah.
You know, or they're going to say something that makes perfect sense in their world, but to adult ears sounds completely bizarre, or, you know, means something else, or is otherwise totally hilarious. And that could be the next thing you write about. You know, I always talk about spending time with kids, and people are probably like, yeah. But there's a reason for it. And that's it. I think when you're around that energy, it gives you permission to let yours out.
Yeah, that's the perfect word, permission. Absolutely. It's like they remind you that making things up is important, and that like it makes us happy, and that we should all be doing this, you know, just like the joy they have by telling some crazy story or like pretending they're a character from a TV show. And not thinking like, is this useful? You know, that's really beautiful to see on a daily basis. And definitely, like you said, makes you feel like you have the permission, gives you more confidence to do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when my older nephew was about 3, he came up with this wild story about what was going on with the radiators in their house, because they had been clanging and banging and making all sorts of noise, and they finally got somebody to come out and fix it. And I mean, I think there were alligators in the pipes and just all of this stuff. And it was just popping out off the top of his head with no thought whatsoever and with no censoring whatsoever, because he was 3. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all stood there and watched this, and I have it on video, which is even better. But, you know, kind of thinking, where are you getting this? But it's the same place you and I can get stuff from if we just let whatever pops into our heads come out. You know, it's the same thing. We can all do it. We've just been trained not to different degrees.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say, that we're just like telling ourselves not to do it, but it's actually natural to us. Yeah.
So I'm sure at some point he'll be mortified that I tell people this story, but I think that's great, which is why I tell it. So Van, if you're listening to this years from now, that's why I've told people this story. So, I mean, there is an energy there that I think we all want back, but we've all forgotten how to get to because it was trained out of us. And I think that's really kind of criminal.
Yeah, definitely. And I try to like, with my kids, I try to be as encouraging as I can of their creativity and of just like enjoying that, not like whether anything is good or like evaluating anything in any way, just like, this is awesome. Everything is awesome. Like everything you draw is awesome. My whole house, like right now I'm in my parents' house, so you can't see it, but in my house, like every wall has like their artwork on it. It looks insane. Like people come to my house, like, why is there just crayon drawings everywhere? But like, they really are proud of that stuff. And I feel like that's important. And like when we're playing pretend games and stuff, like I'm always a character and I have to follow along with whatever their crazy plot line is. But I think that's important because, like I said earlier in the podcast, like I was encouraged and like I feel like I'm happy with my creativity as an adult. So I want to make sure that they can do that too.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing you mentioned that I think is it's a valuable tool, but at the same time, I think it gets in our way all the time. And I know that it's true for myself, and I know that it's true for almost everybody, is that thing in your pocket that you can pull out in the grocery line. And we all do it. Let's be real. We all do it. And yet we miss so much other stuff that's going on because we're staring at the stupid phone all the time. I mean, I love that you deliberately don't do that, because it's a great people watching experience, right? I mean, malls are dying, so they're not as good a place to go to watch people anymore. But, you know, they used to be like you could go and just park yourself on a seat at the mall and watch people and get little snippets of conversation and like make up what's going on in these people's lives that passed you for 10 seconds, you know, and you don't get as many places to do that anymore.
That's so cool that you mentioned the mall, because now I'm going to tell a story that makes me sound like a weirdo. But when I was a teenager, my friends and I used to play a game at the mall where we would each like follow someone creepily and like try to come up with their story, like until the person like realized they were being followed or they like, you know, made a turn or something. And then we would come back together and like make something up. Like I followed this lady who was buying, you know, a baby shower card. And I think she really wants a baby, like just like crazy things. But like the fact that we did that, it was kind of just like this storytelling experience that like, who does that? People don't do that anymore. So I think that that kind of thing can definitely give you ideas and, you know, help you create characters and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Airports are good too, but most of us don't have as many opportunities to be at the airport. And that's probably not a bad thing. But yeah, just paying attention to other people, even for like how people talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, writing dialogue, I remember when somebody told me, you know, but dialogue is not actually how people speak. And I was like, well, yes and no, right? Because if it doesn't sound enough like the way people speak, nobody's going to buy it.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, a fake conversation. So there's that. But we're all pulling on conversations that we've had or that we've heard. So if you're not listening to how people speak, you know, especially if you want to write about somebody who's very different from you, which is where going to a place like the mall, you know, like if I wanted to write about someone from Georgia, it would be great for me to go to Georgia and just sit in a big public place for a while and listen to people. You know, like that's how you learn how this stuff works.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. Dialogue is my favorite part of writing. I feel like it's my strongest, like the strongest part of my writing. So a lot of times if I'm stuck, I'm like, okay, well, I don't know how to describe this, so I'll just let the characters describe it, because I find it so much easier to speak in their voices than to like really nitpick things in my own voice, I guess. So I definitely work a lot on dialogue. And I think it's very important to be careful with how you write the characters' dialogue, like making sure they each sound like themselves or they don't sound the same and that kind of thing. In my novel Games of Chance, I talk a lot about like New Jersey slang and like the Jersey accent and stuff like that. So like about how we pronounce things like mozzarella instead of like mozzarella, and things like chocolate and coffee and that sound, that aw sound. And that serves as a point of connection between two characters, because one character is from Brooklyn and has been like hiding her accent for her whole life because she feels like embarrassed by it. And then when she hears this other character speaking with this really strong accent and not censoring himself, that like attracts her to him. So I really enjoy that. And when going back to what you said about like a character that's different from you, I find that when I do research, like for example, in Games of Chance, there's multiple medical scenes that go on. I interviewed a doctor. In my new novel that I'm writing now, I have a musician as one of the main characters, and I don't play music. So I interviewed multiple musicians, and I feel like interviews are so helpful because you just hear the way that they put things, the way they phrase things, the way, like which words they would use, like all the research in the world, like, you know, on Google or even in books, like doesn't give you that like auditory, like this is how they would say it kind of thing. So.
Yeah. Which is something we don't talk about a whole lot in writing, at least on a general level, is how things sound. You know, we think of words on a page, but when you read them, they have a sound. You know, they have a voice. And some people, you just know, you know, some people write like they talk to the point where when you read what they've written, you hear it in their voice. And like when I talked to Peter Davison a couple of months ago, I told him, like, I heard the whole book in your voice because it sounds so much like you, you know, and yet other times it doesn't, it kind of clangs a little. Like if you're from a certain area and somebody uses the slang wrong or something like that. But the sound of it, there is a musicality to language, whether it's written or spoken, that we don't think about a whole lot, which is a shame because I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's so important. Like hearing it in your head, you know, you hear the words being said in your head and they have to sound right for the character and they have to be like, you know, well done and eloquent and that kind of thing. Yeah. Otherwise it like, it's, you know, it trips up. So I definitely, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. So when you decided to actually write a novel, did anybody, especially, you know, when you're not a kid anymore, did anybody react like, well, what the heck are you doing that for? Or, wow, you really think you can do that?
Not really. I mean, I didn't really talk to that many people about it because I was kind of like, am I really doing this? Like, you know, I mean, like I had written those novels as a teenager, but I had written them with like full confidence of course I'm going to write a novel. I can do anything. You know, like then, you know, I came back to this story and, you know, at the time I was, I had graduated from college, but I couldn't find a job in like editing or anything I was interested in. So I was working at this bar, this dive bar. And I was like, my life is a mess. Like I have, you know, I have no future, whatever, kind of catastrophizing. And I started writing this story and I was like, I really care about this. And you know what? I don't care if it goes anywhere. And I don't care if I never succeed at anything in my life. I'm going to write this story because it speaks to me. And I feel like sometimes it has to come down to that. Like it has to come down to the need to tell the story, you know, forgetting about whether it's going to go anywhere and that kind of thing. And so I just kind of followed that. And I wrote Games of Chance for 10 years. But I took a lot of breaks. I got married. I had my two kids. I got a house. I switched careers a couple times. Right now I'm a stay-at-home mom, but I had multiple other careers before that. And I gave it up a few times, but I always came back to it because I just couldn't let it go. I knew it was the story that I had to tell. So yeah, I think that when you have a story that's really compelling, you can kind of push everything else aside and say like, I have to complete this, even if it's only for me.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the longest amount of time that you were away from it?
That's an interesting question. Maybe like a year or two.
Wow.
Yeah. So what happened was I was teaching for a while. I was a high school Italian teacher, which was really fun. But it was a lot of work and a lot of creative work because I was the first Italian teacher at the school. So I had to make everything. I wrote the curriculum. I did everything from scratch. So I didn't really have time to write and I was kind of feeding my creativity with teaching anyway. And then I stopped working because I had my daughter and I was home, you know, learning how to be a mom and dealing with all of that. And I felt like really just felt that like gap in my life of like, I haven't written anything in so long. And like, it's still calling to me, that kind of thing. So I kept saying like, it's not important. It's not important. It's not important. And finally I got to the point where I was like, I have to try doing this again because it's missing. I know it's missing. And I did. And then I felt like really like happy and fulfilled again by doing that. And then I didn't stop from then. So, sometimes like, I don't know, I feel like having taking a break from it and realizing how much I missed it is part of like what motivates me to continue because I know that I have to do it, whether or not I'm successful, whether or not people care, whether or not, you know, it's the best book ever. It still is just something that feeds a need in me that nothing else can feed.
Absolutely. I'm just impressed that you were away from it for that long and managed to get back into it.
You know what? It was actually really good because I was had so much creative, not creative distance from it. I mean, I guess like I felt like an editor when I came back where I was like, this is not good. Cut this, fix that. Like I had so much clarity versus like right now, the novel I'm writing now, I've been writing for about 2 years and I like, I'm excited about it. I love it. But at the same time, I'm like so in it that I'm like, is this good? I don't know. Like, you know, but with Games of Chance, because I had so much distance from it for a while, I was able to go back and look at it very objectively. And I think that was a benefit to it in the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there you go. You got the silver lining of that experience. I think that's why it's like, you know, the great advice is to set it aside for a while. Like don't stick it in the bottom desk drawer and never think about it again, but give yourself a couple of months away from something before you come back to it, because you will see it so differently when you're stuck in the middle. Just like you say, it's really hard to have that perspective. Because you already know everything you want to do. So to you, it looks like it works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I have a lot of like nervousness about this current novel because, you know, it's very different from my other one. So like this one, the one I'm writing now is in first person. My other novel was in third person. It's in the present tense. My other novel was not in the present tense. And, you know, Games of Chance was, you know, a multi-decade kind of family saga. And this is this very immediate, like I said, present tense novel of only a few years about this, you know, really intense relationship between these characters and in this family. And so I'm like, I don't know if is this my writing style or not, or is the other thing my writing style? And how are people who liked Games of Chance going to feel about this new novel because it's so different? So it's a little bit weird to be doing it the second time around and actually kind of like think about the audience. I feel like that can kind of, I don't know, mess you up when you're trying to work on it.
Yeah, I think if you think about it too much, you can really mess with your own head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember ages ago reading a comment from Philip Pullman about how, you know, I don't decide who my books are for. They decide who my books are for. Not his words, but that's how I remember it. You know, and I think there's a wisdom to that. Like, I just am writing the story that needs to be written, and it can, it's going to find its audience on its own. That's not my job to control that. And I think there's wisdom and freedom in that. And if, obviously, if you're writing a kid's book and, you know, you want to make sure that it stays for kids.
Yeah.
But beyond that, yeah, I think there's a what's the word I want? Like, I hate using secret in this context, but it's what I've got at the moment. You know, like there, one secret to doing good creative work is just letting it be what it wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know. But again, everybody's different.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Philip Pullman, by the way. That's the like Golden Compass and that whole like Philly, right? That was so cool. And that was a very like genre defying thing because it was like marketed to kids, but it's so like complex and like intense.
Oh, yeah.
but I think that there's like a lot of pressure. Like, so I'm self-published. Games of Chance was self-published also. My next novel, I don't know, I might try to go the traditional route, but there's a lot of pressure when you're like an indie author to like, you know, obviously market yourself too. And I feel like writing Games of Chance, I just wrote it the way that it was coming out of me. And this is the book. And I really don't care if anybody reads it or not. And so it was very authentic to what mm-hmm. I, you know, what was inside of me. And then now that this is the second time around, I'm like, oh, well, where would this live on the bookshelf? And like, if I were going to pitch an agent, like what kind of agent? And so it, because you are so like, you have to do everything yourself as a self-published author, it's hard not to let that like marketing department come and like interfere with your process, you know?
Well, and that's, you know, that's totally fair too. I mean, like, because Nancy Springer is one of the few authors that I have heard of and talked to who has written in all sorts of different genres and age groups and whatever. And to the point where I'm really still amazed that they actually encouraged her to do it. They didn't just let her do it. They encouraged her to do it. You know, I mean, her, I can't remember now if she said that it was her agent or her editor who was like, okay, I want you to write, you know, a young adult novel in Victorian London, you know? And she's like, okay. You know? Like, she'd been writing, you know, fantasy stuff forever. And now it's, okay, you want me to do this. And yet, you know, for so many people, it's like, if you want to switch genres, they want you to put a different name on it because, you know, your name is associated with this genre. And there's all of these little marketing slots and things that you have to fit into, or agents and publishers just literally don't know what to do with you, which does make it a whole lot more difficult for authors in particular. I don't know if it's that the same for, you know, artists and musicians and whoever, but certainly for authors, it's like, you still have to either fit into these boxes or explain how you could fit well enough into this box to be put on the science fiction shelf instead of the young adult shelf or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, you know, I wrote the thing. I'm not the one who's supposed to figure out how to sell it. Like, that's your right. job, guys. Like, you know, but it's not like that anymore. It's not like the way that the publishing days used to be. And actually, my uncle used to work at Random House, you know, many years ago. And when I was coming up with a pitch for Games of Chance, I was like pitching at this like indie pitching event. And I was like, well, I have to have like these comp titles and say like what kind of books this is like. And he's like, that's not your job. He's like, I've never heard of an author having to do the comp titles. That's the marketing department's job. And I'm like, but I don't have a marketing department. I'm also the marketing department. But it was like, nice to hear him say that, because it's so foreign to me to market myself. And I was like, maybe there's something wrong with me. But it, the truth is that as artists, we're, you know, about making the art, not so much about right. the other stuff. So, yeah.
And yet, you know, I can't remember now because it's been so long since I pitched an agent, but I know that that's like part of pitching an agent is you figure out what books it's this book crossed with this book, you know, and because that's how they know where to put you and how to think of you. So, yeah. So yeah, I mean, you, if you don't put that kind of stuff in your pitch to an agent, they're just sort of like, you know, it's tough because it feels, at least it did to me, it feels really presumptuous, you know, to say my book is a cross between The Hunger Games and Harry Potter, you know, like who am I to say that? I don't know. You know, I mean, when I read The Hunger Games, I did realize, no, my book is not too dark because it's nowhere near as dark as that. Because I had been worried, but I was like, nope, I got nothing on that right there. It's dark-ish by comparison, but if that is the scale of dark, I'm not there. But still, you know, I mean, like, do I even have it right? I don't know. I mean, I enjoy this stuff, and it feels like kind of like this and kind of like that to me, maybe. I hope, you know. But yeah, it's tough to figure out what to compare yourself to. And I think that's also just generally creatively dangerous, because then you start going, is it really as good as The Hunger Games? The Hunger Games is really good, you know? So it's interesting that he said that, because I get where he's coming from, because that is a marketing thing. But I feel like you kind of have to pre-market yourself when you're trying to sell a book.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, with the whole social media aspect of it too, like, that's something that I, you know, I do social media, I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Goodreads and everything, but I hate it, because it's like, you know, you're trying to figure out what persona to put out there in the world, and put a lot of effort into making your content that you could be using for your actual, like writing your novel, but you right. need to spend it on your content. And like, I still haven't really figured out like who my audience is, you know, like Games of Chance is literary fiction. Okay, I could say that. Who likes to read literary fiction about like people growing from childhood to adulthood. I don't know. I do, but like, I don't know how many me's are out there. Like, it's easier if you have, like, I'm a young adult author or a romance author. It's still like an uphill mm-hmm. battle to market yourself, but like, you kind of know who you're aiming at. And I feel like that's been a struggle for me to figure out who I'm supposed to be reaching out to and like where those people live. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're not a marketer, you're a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, yeah, you have to be all of it. And the social media thing, are we all getting frustrated with social media? Because yeah. I know a lot of people who are just like, can it go away?
I really don't want to spend any more time on Instagram. Seriously.
I know. Instagram in particular annoys me. It's like constantly somebody trying to sell me something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, yeah. So like I said, for my next one, so my next book that I'm writing now is about a musician and a writer who are trying to raise a blended family while also pursuing their creative goals. So it's about parenthood. It's about, it's a love story. And it's also about, you know, the creative process. And the girl in the story also has this cast of like female friends that are like supporting each other, and they all have their own stories. And there's a lot of funny moments, but there's a lot of good advice. And so like, those are all the elements going into this novel. And I'm like, so is this like women's fiction? Like what, where would you put this? Like, it's not a romance novel, but it has a lot of love, but it's not, you know, so it's,
yeah.
And I don't know if that audience for that book is different than the audience for Games of Chance. So it's a strange thing to try to navigate.
Yeah. Well, and women's fiction is just kind of this amorphous thing, I think, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't really deeply looked into it, but there's an awful lot of stuff that seems to fall under women's fiction.
Women read this. It's women's fiction.
Women read this, and we don't know what else to call it, so we're going to call it women's fiction.
Exactly. It's process of elimination, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so weird, because when I first heard that term, it was just a couple of years ago, and I was like, what? But you're right. It's like, there might be romance, but it's not a romance novel. It's like, it's not, it's maybe a little bit more literary than a romance novel, but it's not literary fiction. It's like, oh, Lord.
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that sounds like a really interesting combination of stuff that you've got going on in the current book. That's really cool.
Thank you. I hope so. Yeah. I mean, it kind of like took me by storm. Like I told you, my characters always take over and they're like, hey, you got something to say. Like while I was revising Games of Chance, I had these two characters in my head. They just literally like stormed into my head. They're like, here's our story. Like we gotta, you know, you gotta come listen, you know? So, I was like trying to finish Games of Chance. They'd be like, hold on guys. Like I want to think about you, but I only could do one story at a time. And then as soon as I started writing about them, like it just flowed out of me. Like right now I'm revising and that's a long process and I want to, you know, do it well. But the story itself was just like one of those, like someone turned on the faucet, like it just came pouring mm-hmm. out. So the two of them, the two main characters, just like the chemistry between them, the way they relate to each other. And then the other characters in the book, like their kids and the female friends I mentioned, everybody was so vivid, like right from the beginning. So it was a nice experience. It wasn't so slow as Games of Chance, but again, it leaves me at the end being like, I don't know, this thing just like popped out of me. Like, is it good? I don't know. So
yeah, I love it. I love it when stuff happens like that. So did they start talking to you? Because it sounds like they talk to you like mine do to me, like freaks out people when they write for the first time and their characters actually start talking back and they think they're losing their minds and you're not. Did they start talking to you before you actually put words on the page then?
Yeah. Like I always have like, you know, just people kind of like floating around or like ideas and images and stuff like that floating around. And I had this idea of like these two people who were like at a park with kids and like became friends from that. And that was just kind of this vague thing in the back of my mind for a long time. And then, I don't know, I just suddenly like saw these people in my head. I saw the way they were relating to each other. I was like, oh my God, this would be a good love story. They are like so compatible. And then all of a sudden we just, there we were, we were going like, so, yeah, it was definitely before, but like what I do is like when I get ideas like that, I do write them down, but I don't call it anything or say that I'm starting mm-hmm. a story. I just like write a scene like, oh, there's right. some lines of dialogue or like a description of what the people look like or whatever. So I was always jotting stuff down. And then I didn't totally dedicate myself to like, this is my now, my story now until Games of Chance was totally finished.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, because then you might not have ever finished Games of Chance.
I know. And I'm like, at the time, I didn't want to because I was like, oh my God, it's like the end of the revising process. It's so nitpicky. And here's this really exciting love story. Let's do this instead. But I was disciplined enough to finish the other one first. So, yeah. So now I'm almost finished with this one. And I'm like, what am I going to do next? I don't know.
Oh, somebody else will start popping up and talking to you. I just find it interesting when the characters start talking to me. Usually I've, you know, written at least something, but that's always the moment when I know that I'm onto something because the characters have come to life in my head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to I have this character and they're like this and they do this. And, you know, no, there's a totally different thing when they actually start having conversations with you. You're going, really? You want to do what? Because I've had those conversations too, but it's like, yeah, now there's a life to it now that there wasn't before, and that to me is always the sign that I'm on the right track.
Absolutely, 100% agree. Same way with me. And sometimes it's hard to explain that to people, like you said, who aren't writers, because they're like, "What do you mean? Who are these voices in your head?"
Yeah,
like,
right.
You need help.
You might want to go see the doctor. No, it's fine. It's really okay. There's a whole pile of them in there. We're all good.
It's so true. It's so funny. And like with me, like when I'm stuck, I will just like talk to my characters. Like I do it on paper. I'll be like, okay, you know, Alex, like, why are you acting like this? You know, and then I'll be like, think of Alex talking and write the way that he talks and say like, this is how I feel. I'm really angry about this and blah, 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 blah. And like a lot of times I fix problems that way and like uncover what I was really trying to say. Like we talked about before with like, I want to get to X scene. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get to X scene and I'm like, this doesn't work anymore. I don't know why it doesn't work. I'm just going to have to talk to everybody involved about how they're feeling and figure out what's going on. And like, sometimes now because of how the character has developed, they wouldn't do that anymore. And that's why that scene doesn't work. So it's very important, I think, to be in tune with the characters and not just like pushing them into like a role that you think would be best for the plot.
Yeah. When you try to do that, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they just plain rebel.
Mm-hmm.
you know, because I've had those moments too. And it's like, but you were supposed to go here. And they're like, yeah, I'm not doing that.
I have other plans. Sorry.
No, I'm turning left instead of turning right. Sorry. But that's just what I'm going to do. Sorry. And that still blows my mind because, and I think I've told this story on the show before, but, you know, I remember reading something in like 11th grade. We had to write, you know, a research paper on an author that was assigned to us. So I didn't know anything about this guy and, you know, whatever. And I read a quote from him that said, you know, well, I thought that it was going to be about this, but then my characters decided to do this other thing. And in my infinite, you know, 16, 17 year old brilliance, I read this with just horror and disgust. I was like, you're the author. You're in charge. What do you mean they didn't do what you wanted to do? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And then, you know, here I am 20 years later going, oh, look at that. He didn't do what I wanted him to do. I get it now. Never mind.
Yes, but it's so true. That's how you know you have a good story and like that people are really going to feel like your characters are real. Like that's, yeah. People say that to me all the time. Like, I can't believe like these aren't real people. Like, I feel like they're in my family. Like, that's how well I know them. And I'm like, that's how well I know them too. Like, I'm glad that came across because yeah, that's the fun part for me is like having these new friends.
Yeah.
Hang out with, you know,
and you don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah. You're very unpredictable.
Maybe a little of what they're going to do, but you don't know anywhere near all of what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And that, as you say, that's what makes it fun. That's part of why if I had to plot something out, I'd never write it because I would already know what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So if you are thinking about writing, know that you have choices. You don't have to plot it out. And if you start hearing people in your head, it doesn't mean you're crazy. It means it's working.
Exactly.
Wow. So you don't know what's next for you, except you're going to get this book out there and see what happens and figure out what category it belongs in.
Yeah. Where it's going to live on the bookshelf. Yeah. I want to get this one out there. And I mean, I have some other ideas swirling around. I'm kind of like, I have another, some ideas about like kind of like a small town, you know, drama kind of thing with like multiple characters involved that are kind of talking to me. And then part of me is also like, should I just try to do something totally crazy? Like nothing like I've ever done. Like sometimes that's good too, to like switch it up. But ultimately, I never really follow through with anything unless I have characters that like really compel me. So, and it sounds like that's the way it is for you too. So I guess I'll find those people to latch onto, regardless of what the genre is or the plot is.
I think they'll latch onto you.
Yeah, right, that's true.
Well, that's awesome. And I just wondered if you could share briefly before we go, because I thought this was so cool. For people who are listening, I send out a form for guests to fill out so that I have all of their info and stuff. And it's got some questions on there. And I asked what the best piece of advice was that you've ever gotten. And I loved your answer. And I wondered if you could share it with the rest of us.
Sure. So my dad always says, do what you're compelled to do. So this sounds like very simple advice, but the word compelled is the key to the sentence, right? So the idea is that like, you know, not every decision you feel like very strongly about, but when you are faced with a decision and you know your gut is telling you like, I have to do this, regardless of other people's opinions, regardless of what the logic might say, I have to do this, my gut is telling me, then that's what you should do. And he said this to me many times, like when it came to like buying a house or when it comes to just like friendships, relationships, choosing a career, things like that, like that this is a piece of advice that's really applicable to everything. And the fact that, you know, he said that to me and kind of gave me the license to be like, you should trust your gut, like, mm-hmm. you know, even more than what I tell you, you know what you need to do kind of thing is very empowering. And I think that's important because it's very easy to get into like a pros and cons list or like, you know, to try to logically understand things. And of course we should do that. We shouldn't just be, you know, completely illogical, but with major life decisions, a lot of times you have a really strong feeling about what you need to do and you should do that. So do what you're compelled to do. That's his advice.
I love it. And I think the pros and cons list is often, I know what I need to do, but I need to validate it somehow.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like I have to have it come from something else, not just from my gut. And I think that, you know, there are moments you need to go with your gut.
Definitely.
Yeah. So that's great. That's fabulous advice. So I appreciate you sharing it, and I appreciate you coming and talking with me.
Yeah, of course. It's been great.
That's this week's episode. Thanks so much to Raquel Drossos for joining me and to you for listening. Please leave a review for this episode. There is a link right there in your podcast app. And in it, tell us about a moment when your creative work came to life for you. If you enjoyed our conversation, I hope you'll share it with a friend. Thank you so much. If this episode resonated with you, or if you're feeling a little bit less than confident in your creative process right now, join me at The Spark on Substack as we form a community that supports and celebrates each other's creative courage. It's free, and it's also where I'll be adding programs for subscribers and listeners. The link is in your podcast app, so sign up today. See you there, and see you next week. Follow Your Curiosity is produced by me, Nancy Norbeck, with music by Joseph McDade. If you like Follow Your Curiosity, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your friends. It really helps me reach new listeners.